You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, John.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let me introduce you. So I'm Robert Wright. You are John Glazer, head of, I guess, foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. Is that the exact title?
Something like that. Director. What they say. Yeah.
Yeah, head would be a little... Did I say head? That's too informal. You're worthy of more than that.
I don't know about that.
You've written a lot of, you've written for all the op-ed places, right? New York Times and so on. And you got a book coming out in the fall. Is that right?
Co-authored
with Chris Pebble, who's also at Cato, I believe. He's still at Cato, right?
He's my boss. Yeah, he's vice president of foreign policy studies at Cato. It's actually, there's three authors. So there's me and there's him and there's this guy called Trevor Thrall, who's a senior fellow here and also teaches at George Mason. We're true to our burden sharing argument, taking three authors for one book.
Okay, so you're ideologically consistent. The title of the book is Fuel to the Fire, How Trump Made America's Broken Foreign Policy Even Worse, and how we can recover. Not out yet, but it will be in a few months. And we may talk about some themes that are in the book. Before we get started talking about Trump per se, let's talk a little about the idea of being a libertarian and thinking about foreign policy. Because I think, when people think of libertarians, they think mainly of, economic policy, domestic policy, and of course, they think conservative. They think at the conservative end of the spectrum on those kinds of issues. But it turns out that that doesn't necessarily imply the foreign policy that you might expect, because I think a lot of people associate, when they think of right-wing foreign policy, in fact, just not that long ago, I tweeted that somebody had a right-wing foreign policy, and a couple of people got upset because they said, well, you mean hawkish. But that's not the same as right wing. And I had to kind of concede the point, although the two have come to be conflated, right? So when people think conservative foreign policy, they think hawkish, but in your case, that would be a mistake, right?
Yeah, I mean, so labels tend to mean more trouble than they're worth, but people should understand at this point, at least, that libertarianism is not conservative. I reject the C word strongly.
Even in the realm of domestic economic policy?
Well, we like free markets. We like low taxes. We like very limited government. But that translates to a lot of other things that are associated with the left. So Cato is in favor of same-sex marriage before it became cool. Right. And we're for drug decriminalization and criminal justice reform, and we do work on police abuse. We are civil libertarians as well. So things like we had Edward Snowden webcam into an event once. We think his disclosures were good. And the NSA violated rights on a massive scale in the post 9/11 years. And when it comes to war, I mean, it just makes perfect sense. If you think there's value in having power domestically that's limited and constrained, you definitely want to constrain war powers, because as the founders always said, it's the war is the germ of the growth of bureaucracy, the growth of government power, violations of civil liberties, rollbacks of press freedoms. I mean, think back to the Adams administration and, the Alien Sedition Act.
That's a long ways. You may have to remind us.
Well, let's just forget the history for a moment, but the government tends to grow, in times of war. And so in the context of U.S. foreign policy today, we're constantly at war. We have a really unique foreign policy, actually, outstrips any other country by comparison in terms of how often we're at war, how activist we are, our global military presence, and so on.
That's interesting. So one of the primary libertarian arguments against a highly militaristic foreign policy is its effect on the nature of domestic governance.
Yeah, absolutely. And philosophically, you know, we're just very skeptical of the use of force and coercion. That's why we're skeptical of government to begin with, because every government policy has force and coercion behind it. And so, you know, my libertarian feelings are activated when we go to war for terrible reasons, like in Iraq, and get hundreds of thousands of people killed, when we throw people in jails and torture them in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, when we're supporting one of the most regressive authoritarian regimes in the world as they commit war crimes in neighboring Yemen, which is largely defenseless and impoverished society that they're just laying under siege. So, yeah, force and coercion, human rights, individual liberties, these things are important to libertarians, so people shouldn't be too surprised that we're rather dovish.
Yeah, okay. I guess also you're probably not enthusiastic about the effect that war tends to have on international trade, right?
Yeah, we're big free traders, part of our frustration with Trump, big time. And not only, I think there's a feedback loop. I mean, there's that old saw about if goods cross borders, armies won't. But it's also true that the greater reliance and interdependence you have on other countries through trade, the less likely you are to see them as an enemy and to want to damage your own economic prospects by bombing them.
Yeah. There are hawkish libertarians. I mean, I'm thinking of Glenn Reynolds, Instapundit, of Instapundit fame. So, but is it more generally the case that libertarians are dovish? That's an actual clear pattern?
Well, from my perspective, I mean, this is why I said labels are more trouble than they're worth. People like to use the term libertarian to describe themselves, even if I don't think that they're really on the train. So yeah, there are a lot of hawks. I know some libertarians who self-describe libertarians who are a bit more hawkish than me. But then again, that's not very hard to do. Most people are more hawkish than me.
So let's talk a little about Donald Trump. There were people who are non-interventionists, you know, kind of anti-militarists, who had high hopes for him. Were you, because he was talking that kind of game to some extent during the political campaign, although it was a little ambiguous sometimes. Were you one of those who had
no? No, I thought he ran a disgusting campaign from the beginning. It was, I think, morally outrageous. It was xenophobic. His demonstration of his policy chops was left something to be desired. Let's say that. And I knew that he would turn out to be a hawk. I mean, yes, he occasionally said some things that blended with non-interventionist libertarian types like me, like, hey, let's not do regime change wars anymore. And, maybe Europe and Asia can take care of their own security a bit more. But he also said things on the stage like, I'm the most militaristic person on this stage in the Republican debates. He said things like, I'm going to ramp up the air war against ISIS and maybe kill their families as well. You know, he wanted to bring back torture. I think he views the world in very zero-sum terms. And that translates into a really confrontational foreign policy most of the time.
Uh-huh. Just out of curiosity, what was your view of what should have been done with ISIS?
Well, first of all, we should have acknowledged the reality, which is that ISIS is an outgrowth of the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, and it's a consequence of our idiotic foreign policy. Much of their motive in the early years, that 2014 era, when Obama was trying to figure out how to approach this, was to goad the United States into another ground war. I mean, the trouble with these non-state actor groups is that they don't have power projection capabilities. It's not easy for them to conduct transnational attacks, especially on a distant country like ours that has a big military and an intelligence community and stuff like that. And so they need to draw us in. That's what I did not want to do. I think most of the air war was not justified. I could have seen a fair justification for a limited air campaign against ISIS. The problem is there's no legal justification for it. So to rely on the AUMF from 02 or 01
That's justified. The authorization for the use of military force.
Right, which came about after
9/11.
And then to attack Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that's dubious in the best of times. And so any constitutionally regulated executive branch that respects the rule of law has to ask Congress to use military force. That's just basic. We don't do that at all, ever. But if we were going to engage in an air campaign against ISIS, we should have had a national debate about what to do. We should have put the threat that they pose in context. I think they posed a very limited threat to the United States. And we should have taken into account the possible consequences. So Obama ramped up the air war big time. And then Trump came in and changed the rules of engagement slightly, that is to say, loosened them. And the civilian casualty rate went up about 215% in the first year and a half. This is no way to run a war, in my opinion. And so I was and still remain deeply skeptical that we need to be constantly in the air over Iraq and Syria, bombing roving militants. There needs to be a very clear and present danger to the United States in order to justify U.S. military action abroad, and it needs to be legal.
Right. So, So there is a big emphasis on the sheer legality of the war in terms of American domestic law, right? On the libertarian side, I mean, both because I think people in general should be in favor of the rule of law, but also libertarians are very suspicious of, the kind of expansion of executive power, especially when it doesn't seem warranted by the actual law. What about international law? To what extent does it bother you, say, that the Iraq War was pretty clearly illegal under international law? Basically, under international law, two times war is justified. Or if a country actually attacks you, then you're allowed to exercise self-defense, or B, the UN Security Council authorizes your attack on grounds of, in the name of international peace and security. There are various grounds for that. But if you don't have a Security Council's backing, which we didn't in Iraq, and the country hasn't attacked you, which Iraq certainly hadn't done, you're not, under international law, you're not supposed to do anything. Does that loom at all in your thinking as a libertarian, or very large, or what?
I argue a lot that we should abide by international law, particularly the UN Charter. I mean, the UN Charter is a document that emphasizes non-intervention, that emphasizes sovereignty, and that prohibits war, essentially, except under very clear circumstances that you just described. A lot of libertarians don't like international law. I would say I'm an outlier there. They view it as a sort of encroachment on U.S. sovereignty, and certainly to uplift any international governing body is something that irks libertarians in terms of just being skeptical of the concentration of power. However, there is a clause in the Constitution that says when you sign and ratify a treaty, it becomes the supreme law of the land. So we are a high contracting party to the UN Charter, and we should abide by it, particularly if we're going to base our foreign policy so much on condemning and punishing and sanctioning and going to war against countries who we say violate international law. We do it as a matter of routine.
Right. And do you feel okay, like, just to briefly get into other realms of international law? I would think some libertarians might be fine with the World Trade Organization. You could argue that it's an encroachment on sovereignty in the extent that you are supposed to respect its adjudicatory decisions and only retaliate for a tariff if it deems the tariff unlawful and authorizes that specific retaliation. But in principle, it could do a good job of actually nurturing international trade, which libertarians love, right?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the work we do, our Trade Department does here at Cato, certainly is perfectly within that realm that you just described. The worry about encroachments on sovereignty, I don't really buy. I mean, at the end of the day, international economic institutions, bodies like the United Nations, legal regimes like the international law regime that we have are just fundamentally more a way of encouraging cooperation among states, dampening the sort of security dilemma that that states face in an anarchic international system. And they're pretty, even if they are some kind of sacrifice of sovereignty in some philosophical or even marginal sense, they're probably worth it because war is much worse than that minor forfeiture of sovereignty from and, you know, so most of the time these are just very minor things to help cooperate in an international system, and I broadly support them. This kind of approach is a discussion of this what's I think thankfully now becoming a bit of a dated discussion, but the liberal world order or the rules-based international liberal order, as it's variously called, you know, I broadly support the part that we talked about, the international law, diplomacy through the United Nations, WTO, etc. It's just the security element, the part of U.S. foreign policy based on hard power that says we need to police the world, guarantee the security of 60 or 70 nations around the world by treaty and then some additional ones, non-treaty allies, that we need to, have a global military presence that's constantly in everybody's business. That part of the liberal international order I don't support. And I don't think actually to have a functioning international economic system and a functioning UN system, I don't think you actually need American hard power. And so that part of it, I just don't accept.
So that particular theme of Trump's campaign rhetoric, you might have felt okay about, right? I mean, he was inclined to look at all of these commitments, and say, what's in it for us? You know, why are we, committing our troops, and in some cases our money, although in some cases we get various kinds of compensation, I guess. But, you know, for the security of these countries that are themselves pretty affluent. I mean, Japan, Western Europe, and often not under any kind of obvious actual threat of invasion. So that part of what Trump said, you probably resonated with.
Yeah, when he said NATO is obsolete, I agreed. I don't think that it should be a core pillar of U.S. foreign policy to guarantee the security of rich and powerful nations that can and should defend themselves. Liberal order types will argue that, well, without those security guarantees, the world would be much more dangerous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by reassuring allies, we disincentivize them from building up their own military capability. And that prevents all kinds of arms races and conflict spirals. And then simultaneously, we deter the big major powers like Russia and China, say. And so being a distant power and doing that really does dampen the war-prone nature of the international system. But I don't agree. In fact, that argument is only a consensus view in Washington, D.C. If you look at academia, there's a robust debate about what has caused the so-called long peace. You know, it is true that since 1945, the rate and incidence of interstate war has gone down. You know, average battle deaths have gone down. Even civil wars after a slight uptick in the post-Cold War era have gone down. And so probably the most important question is, why is there peace? Because we are living in relatively peaceful times despite the news cycle. And we have to answer that question. And, you know, there are a lot of answers. So some people point to the inauguration of nuclear weapons, the international system. Back in 1945, the same time we started to set up this liberal international order, the great powers and then some not so great powers started to get nuclear weapons, and that makes war among the great powers, and great power war is the most costly and devastating throughout history, really not doable because it's just too darn costly. And then conventional military power, you know, just the destructive potential of bombs and bullets, as we saw in World War One and World War Two, is also so destructive that it really doesn't make it worth it for most states to engage in it. International economic interdependence, you know, I think that has, that in some sense is an emergent phenomenon, exogenous to U.S. designs. And sometimes we've helped it. Sometimes we've promoted economic interdependence, but sometimes we haven't. And sometimes it's just building up on its own. Some people emphasize norms. You know, if you look back 100 years in our history, it's pretty easy to find political leaders in the United States and Western Europe talking about war as something to aspire to. You know, as a cleansing national experience that made a country manly and virtuous.
Teddy Roosevelt. And
today's warmongers tend to talk about war as something of a last resort, and that does represent a kind of normative shift. John Mueller, who's also a senior fellow here, is, and also a political scientist at Ohio State, is a big proponent of this view. And he points out that, you know, chattel slavery used to be a fixture of every human civilization, and eventually along the way, people just became more civilized and recognized it as a barbarity. Dueling used to be a common practice to settle disputes, and now we don't do that anymore. Torture has kind of, most, for the most part, in most developed countries, gone by the wayside. And this is a kind of slow moral progress, and war, same thing might be happening with war. And then people point to international law and all this kind of stuff. There are a lot of good arguments for why there is peace today. And it's probably overdetermined. Probably lots of things contribute. I don't think that it's been U.S. foreign policy that has done it.
Yeah. Now, of course, what some people would say is you're right that wars among nations have declined in frequency. We haven't been threatened by one in a long time, at least. We haven't lost a lot of people by historical standards in one in a long time. I mean, we, like Vietnam, we lost, you know, 58,000. There's been nothing like that since. And Vietnam was itself a drop in the bucket compared to World War II.
And we never had to fight Vietnam.
And what's that? Oh, well, yeah, that, in other words, there was no need to.
Yeah, these are elective wars that we're engaging in for spurious reasons, for the most part.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we have to deal with those costs, they're self-imposed. Those aren't a necessity.
You know what's interesting? I came across, you know, there's this book that was just came out about Richard Holbrooke, I guess, this long time, you know, U.S. kind of diplomat, you know, associated more with liberals and conservatives, I guess. But apparently in his diary during Vietnam, you know, he's a very young guy, but he said, I don't doubt that if we lose here, the communists will be in like Mexico. I mean, I think he listed Mexico in particular, certainly Latin America. And it's like, that seems, you know, in retrospect, at least, that seems kind of crazy. But, you know, it's just a testament to how, I don't know, how paranoid thinking is among human beings in general often, how threats are exaggerated, how things that adversaries do for defensive reasons are interpreted as offensive things. I mean, we're seeing this now, I think, with Iran. You know, everything Iran, you know, the Trump administration wants to interpret everything Iran does as offensive. And you could argue that, you know, Iran has had a kind of traumatic history, actually. The Iran-Iraq war, which it did not start, killed huge numbers of Iranians. And so when, for example, and the U.S. was, if anything, on Saddam Hussein's side in that, right? And so when the U.S. occupies Iraq, yeah, I'm not shocked if Iran supports some militias who try to make life so uncomfortable for us that we get the hell out of there. That doesn't surprise, you know, you can interpret all these things as just kind of natural defensive responses. You can interpret what Iran is doing in Syria as wanting to establish a defensive buffer, given various countries in the region who wish it ill. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to sermonize for too long. It's just such a chronic feature of human history that people arguably misread signals in a way that leads to a more militaristic foreign policy than is absolutely necessary. I certainly think Vietnam was like totally misread the very nature of that war and the nature, what was actually motivating North Vietnam and the Viet Cong.
Yeah, look, all you have to do is look at a map of the Middle East to understand that Iran might be concerned about its security. I mean, the United States over the last 2 years has invaded and occupied for lengthy periods the countries on Iran's immediate east and west borders. We constantly flood the Persian Gulf directly to Iran's south with fleets of Navy warships. We are best friends with Iran's two most vociferous regional adversaries, Israel and Saudi Arabia, both of whom have publicly and in private talked about the need for the United States or them in cooperation to attack Iran. And then you have a whole history of U.S. foreign policy making here domestically in the United States that talks about Iran as this huge enemy and this evil force in the world that we need to confront perhaps militarily and the regime we have to overthrow. So, I mean, if Iran had even one thousandth of the aggressiveness of the U.S. military and U.S. foreign policy, we would light our hair on fire. But I agree with you that it's kind of a feature of human nature to inflate threats, but there's a reason why we do it more in U.S. foreign policy. And that's because of the grand strategy that we have. It's based on this hegemonic stability theory, this idea that there needs to be one powerful country in the world that can police it and create the peace in order to have a lot of economic interdependence so that we can protect allies around the world and punish rogue states that don't conform to the international system, et cetera, et cetera. And that makes it so you see threats in every nook and cranny. That makes you feel paranoid that around every corner is some existential peril. So in the Cold War, and there's strategic reasons for this. So in the Cold War, if you remember, like extended deterrence, right? There was always this question about how do we communicate to the Soviets that we really will sacrifice our own blood and treasure for Berlin or Tokyo or whatever. It's really hard. It's really easy to tell countries, hey, we'll attack you if you attack us because it's our sovereign territory. But it's a hard thing to make credible threats that you'll protect countries far off in the distance that aren't your own. And the way to do that is really to just be really warlike. We need to prove to the world, particularly our perceived adversaries, that we will go to war for peripheral interests. So if you're going to have this foreign policy, if you're going to have a grand strategy that says we're the global hegemon, we provide global public goods, we provide security, we police the world, you almost have to go to war all the time, or else nobody will believe the threats and promises that you make.
So you alluded to the difference in prevailing perspective between academic, you know, students of foreign policy, the people at universities all over America who study international relations, and kind of think tanks in D.C., the kind of foreign policy establishment. Mm-hmm. And the foreign policy establishment seems more militaristic than the academic community, and seems more to buy into this idea that you've got to have a single hegemon to ensure the peace, as opposed to, say, nurturing respect for international law and international norms by abiding by them, which we don't do by and large. Why is there such a contrast? Why are these two communities of people so different in their outlook? Because you are an outlier in Washington, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, Cato is strange because, I mean, we've been dovish from our inception. We were pretty much alone. This is long before my time at Cato, but pretty much alone among the major think tanks in opposing the Iraq War. And we lost money. I mean, we donors pulled out because we took that position. So yes, we are different. We're basically the only major think tank that doesn't agree with primacy, as it's sometimes called, this grand strategy that the United States have, sometimes called liberal hegemony. People have different words for it. Whereas in academia, you'll find a lot more support for restraint, which is what we argue for. And there are a lot of reasons for it. So historically, we understand that we had to rise to the occasion in World War II and battle Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, and that took a global effort. And we were left with certain sets of responsibilities after that. And, you know, democracies are systems in which when a program is begun, a whole effort, you know, grows up around it to maintain it. You think about this in any field. You know, we still have agricultural subsidies. Why? Because it's important. There's concentrated benefits for certain groups of people to make sure that that's continued. And the costs are so diffuse that nobody raises a challenge to it. So the military-industrial complex grew up, but also an intellectual community grew up that was surrounded on the, was based on these ideas that the United States has to play this role in the world. And, you know, I think a lot of the discussion about the foreign policy establishment gets stuck because partly because of this term blob. People don't like, nobody likes being part of a blob, right? And so they find it insulting, and so they challenge you, et cetera. But we're really describing a very mundane thing, which is that communities of people begin to develop like minds about things, and groupthink develops, and people that dissent from that are kind of not invited to the next meeting, and so on and so forth. So that's happening. The other thing that's happening is that people have to remember that think tanks essentially serve power. And if policymakers don't find that they can use think tank advice, they won't rely on it. So most think tanks, when it comes to foreign policy, talk about how do we better implement our current set of responsibilities. It's an operational mindset. How do we do this more effectively, more efficiently? How do we better do regime change? How do we do counterinsurgency better and more effectively? How do we better chase terrorists around the world? Not whether we should be doing any of those things, but how do we do it better? And the reason is because if policymakers come to a think tank and say, hey, we're going to invade Iraq, or we're going to engage in this massive air campaign, or we need to figure out ways to contain China, a think tank that says, well, you shouldn't really be doing this stuff, and for all these good IR scholarly reasons, here's why you shouldn't really put much weight behind those efforts. You know, they're not going to find much use for it. And so it's a self-perpetuating system.
And I mean, to put a finer point on it, they're not going to ask you to serve in their administration. I mean, you know, most think tanks in Washington consist mainly of people who would like a job in government, for the most part, you know, in particular in the White House. And, you know, I remember when, I guess it was Obama, it was his first election. So he's running against McCain, right? I remember when he came out as something of a hawk on Afghanistan during the campaign. I mean, we already knew McCain wasn't going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. Once Obama said he wasn't either, I thought, well, from now on, you're not going to see many think tank people advocate pulling the troops out of Afghanistan, because they know then they can't get a job in the White House no matter who wins. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate the influence of kind of presidential politics and party politics on what people in think tanks say is that strong, right? And I think that's part of the reason that people in academia exhibit more diversity of thought. Most of them aren't imagining getting a job in the White House.
Right, and nor do I, which is why I find
Exactly. I was going to say, Cato was the one place where I think when it comes to foreign policy, at least.
We don't have much of a revolving door, but everyone else does. And yes, you're right. But so it is the case that if your job depends on arguing for a really aggressive and activist foreign policy, you will tend to do that. But it's also the case that they just share an intellectual commitment to these ideas. And yeah, so you don't get a lot of diversity of opinion. It really pains me to give Trump any credit for anything, but it is thanks to him somewhat that we're seeing a bit of a shakeup in the consensus that dominated for so long in the think tank community. It was just a couple of weeks ago that I think it was CNAS hosted a...
That's the Center for New American Security. Kind of, I guess, identifies as liberal, but it gets money from arms manufacturers and so on. It has a somewhat, blob.
Sort of just establishment, really. Yeah. It doesn't have a hugely partisan tilt, but they hosted a debate on grand strategy. We submitted, my colleague Emma Ashford submitted an essay. They brought in people from academia to explain offshore balancing and argue for restraint and so on. That kind of thing is happening more and more. And I think it's because Trump was a bit of a shock to the system and kind of punctured a lot of sacred cows. And so we're seeing that a little bit.
Well, I guess that's good. But speaking of Trump, so how concerned are you about Iran right now? As we tape this, I'm not sure exactly when this will run, but there's been a fresh round of saber rattling on Iran. So like a couple of days ago, I guess, was it 2 days ago that John Bolton said, we're sending a carrier group to Iran or something. It turns out that it was actually a group that was pretty much headed that way. Anyway, maybe it sped up or something, but he cited a vague reason to believe Iran was planning something. I don't know what the state of play. My understanding is that the more people have looked into this, the more it looks half made up in terms of the intelligence. But it's cause for concern. I mean, everyone knows that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, Bolton, of course, is National Security Advisor, have in the past embraced regime change in Iran. Bolton seems to have a real bee in his bonnet. And of course, Trump got out of this nuclear deal that Iran was completely complying with and, in fact, has complied with since, even after Trump got out of it and quit and deprived Iran of the economic benefits of continued compliance. But Iran has continued to put up with the inspections and monitoring, which is very tight in their nuclear energy plants. Now, ominously, Iran, you're seeing reports that Iran is maybe not going to keep doing this and they're going to kick out some inspectors or something. How concerned are you about this situation right now?
Yeah, it's deeply concerning. I'm first of all concerned that there's not a lick of strategy in our Iran policy. We're essentially punishing Iran for complying with one of the most robust and rigorous non-proliferation agreements ever negotiated. It's significantly rolled back its nuclear capabilities, forfeited 97% or something like that of its enriched uranium, 2/3 of its operating centrifuges. It was a set of major concessions that, as you say, they are still to this day complying with. And for a guy that says he really is worried about proliferation of nuclear weapons, John Bolton is doing a great job of incentivizing proliferation of nuclear weapons. Not that I think Iran is going to start to go down that path. If they start to violate the JCPOA on the margins, it's probably going to be done as more as a signal than a real indication that they're going to pursue the bomb in earnest. But it's just we're needlessly obsessed with this third-rate military power, half a world away, that frankly is less threatening to U.S. interests than our relationship with the Sunni Arab Gulf states. Mm-hmm. Those are a threat to U.S. interests because they have a way of influencing U.S. foreign policy in the region. They also have, as we know, a long history of supporting the kinds of Sunni terrorist groups that actually want to attack the United States. This Iran is a situation of psychotically inflated threats, and it's not even clear what the Trump administration wants to get out of it. Trump himself, I think, thinks that with enough pressure, the Iranians will buckle and they'll come to the negotiating table and, you know, make concessions that they wouldn't make to the Obama administration. That last part is a bit flimsy. He might just want, I mean, all he cares about, it seems to me, in his diplomacy with North Korea is the pageantry of it, not the substance. And I would bet whatever's in my wallet right now, it's not that much, that he never read a word of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. He backed out of it because it irked him that it was Obama's deal. Well, John Bolton has a more sort of ideological position on Iran and just doesn't think we should give them an inch. But
yeah, I think if he wants a better deal, and I suspect that that's what Bolton is telling him, because Bolton doesn't want to tell him, hey, I'm hoping to get you into a war. You know, he wants to tell him, don't worry, all the intimidation will work. But I think if they want it to work toward a better deal, I don't think it's only or even primarily the nuclear deal. They want Iran to agree to quit doing the things that nations just normally do. I mean, nations generally have the sovereignty to develop ballistic missiles if they want. There's no like rule against it. They haven't signed a treaty. You know, this is conventional. You know, these would be conventionally armed ballistic missiles. They want them to like get out of Syria, whereas the government of Syria, you may or may not like the government of Syria, but it is the government of, it is still Assad that's governing Syria, you know, wants Iran in Syria. So they are there with the permission of the government. That's
like us
and so on. So the Trump administration would like all this to change. And it's asking in that sense for a pretty extraordinary commitment to self-restraint from Iran, but I think that's what it really wants.
One of those things have a great bearing on U.S. security interests. I mean, the latest news before we started recording on this Bolton sending a carrier and seizing on some intelligence to pretend like a long scheduled deployment to the Persian Gulf was actually a deterrent threat to Iran. The latest news was that the threat was actually that Iran was moving around short-range ballistic missiles on some boats. Who cares? What does that have to do with U.S. foreign policy or U.S. national security? It doesn't. Mm-hmm. By adopting a position which says that we want Iran to fundamentally change the nature of its regime, to stop having a foreign policy, and to stop taking measures to defend itself by building ballistic missiles, we're exporting our foreign policy preferences, I think, to our allies in the region who care about, you know, keeping Iran down. To them, Iran is a more proximate threat.
We're outsourcing our foreign policy preferences. I mean, we're not imposing our preferences on Israel. We're adopting
right. And that leads to the question of, well, are we really served by these alliances? And I think no. We don't even have to have a forward presence in the Gulf. I mean, this claim that we have to constantly patrol the Persian Gulf to keep the waterway open for oil markers to survive is, to me, a bunch of shenanigans. Iran threatens to close the Straits of Hormuz, usually as a way to counter U.S. threats against it. Mm-hmm. But they export most of their oil through the Strait. They're not going to do that. By preventing them from exporting any oil, as we are currently doing, by getting rid of all the waivers on the oil sanctions that we have on them, we're actually making the Strait of Hormuz less important for them to stay open. And so we're encouraging this riling of the oil markets.
And this whole amazing business of the way we have pretty successfully coerced various countries into complying with our unilateral sanctions regime, which they're not enthusiastic about, but we're basically saying any country in the world that buys oil from Iran, we will sanction, and for the most part, they're living with it. I don't know how China's going to react, but
I think. In the near term, our allies and partners, whatever you want to call the rest of the countries that we're lifted, you know, getting rid of the waivers for, are can't com- they don't want to make a choice between the Iranian economy, which is paltry, and the gargantuan U.S. economy. It's much easier to comply with these sanctions and deal with whatever economic consequences that brings about than to just, you know, comply with them and keep maintain access to the U.S. economy. But we also have the dollar as the reserve currency, so that gives us a lot of leverage in doing this kind of thing. Over the long term, though, I think we're signaling to Europe and China and Japan and South Korea and so on that we really can't be trusted as the guarantor of the global economy if this is how we're going to act.
Now, and I got to think it's going to come back to haunt us. I mean, one thing we exploit when we're doing this is the control we have over the international banking system just by virtue of the fact that the United States became economically dominant after World War II. And, you know, you're already starting to see, like, Europe, you know, develop this admittedly half-assed kind of thing that's supposed to, permit some kind of trade with Iran that's an alternative to U.S. financial mechanisms or something I don't understand. And so far, it hasn't hurt us in a big way. I just don't think we can get away with abusing our privilege of being at the center of the international financial system without more and more alternatives developing. I don't know.
And it is an abuse. And our relative power in the international system is gradually declining. I mean, we're still pretending to operate as if it's 1945 when we had 5% of the world's population and 50% of its wealth. And that we had a monopoly on possession of nuclear weapons. And, you know, we far outstripped the war ravaged Europe and Asia. That's not the case anymore. We represent about 13% of the global economy now. And so we need to deal with changing conditions. And if we just stick with this grand strategy that says we need to be everywhere at all times and that we have major existential threats, at our, you know, breathing down our neck in every direction, it's going to be very, very messy. We're a weird country. We have a very, very unique foreign policy. We're extremely, extremely safe. We're one of the safest countries in the world. We face no real threats from states. We have weak and pliant neighbors to the north and south and lots of fish to the east and west. Water acts as a sort of protection against most conventional threats. We have a nuclear deterrent, a huge economy, you know, the world's most capable military. And the international system is more peaceful than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And so we don't face it much threats, and yet we have the most activist foreign policy in the world.
Well, it seems to me the most plausible actual threat is terrorism, including homegrown terrorism, because you can imagine a situation where there's like this positive feedback cycle that leads terrorism to become more of a problem. You know, you're arguably seeing a little of this when you see white nationalist attacks a mosque in New Zealand. And although the Sri Lankan thing probably wasn't retaliation for that, that kind of dynamic could well develop. And as it amps up, jihadist recruiters have an easier time of recruiting, American terrorists and so on. But of course, the irony of that is, I think you probably agree with me that we have done as much as anybody to create the soil for that, but with things like, you know, the invasion of Iraq, and we continue to do it.
Yeah. So the first of all, terrorism is a minor and manageable problem. It's not a threat that we need to confront militarily. The use of military force is not even all that useful in combating.
Well, I would say it's actively counterproductive.
Yeah. I mean, look, in Iraq, by 2006, the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq said that we were breeding deep resentment of U.S. foreign policy and contributing to a whole, you know, basically breeding a new generation of jihadist sympathizers and fighters. So that's Iraq. Then we did Libya. We created anarchy in a situation that we didn't need to intervene in my opinion. That contributed to a whole host of terrorist groups rising out of Libya. In Syria, we cooperated with our Gulf allies to support rebel groups, many of whom had jihadist sympathies, and we destabilized the civil war such that it was prolonged and exacerbated, where all these groups, these militants, could really grow. It seems at every turn we make a decision which actually exacerbates the terrorist problem as opposed to mitigates it. And
and the terrorists themselves cite these things incredibly. Right. I mean, the Boston Marathon bomber was intent on getting across to us.
Yes.
It was about like the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the Pulse nightclub shooter, same way when he called 9/11 from the scene. And that was the first thing out of his mouth. I mean, he called 911. He called the cops. First thing out of his mouth was like Iraq, Syria. Going back to this guy, Major Hassan, who shot up these people at Fort Hood. Same thing. I mean, he didn't cite it explicitly, but it was pretty clearly causative.
Times Square bomber also cited strikes on
Bain. Times Square bombers, Pakistani.
And now in Yemen. Our policy in Yemen, the consequence of it has been to bolster the position of AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, at every point, our foreign policy that is allegedly supposed to protect us from terrorism has actually exacerbated the threat. That's not to say, however, that it is a major threat. It's a minor and manageable problem, should be dealt with mostly through law enforcement and intelligence. And the application of military force is, if anything, making the problem worse as opposed to resolving it.
Yeah. No, it must be frustrating for you because I basically share your view on how almost absurd America's foreign policy is in terms of not only its disconnect with anything logically related to our actual defense, but its actual exacerbation. Is that
yes.
Term? Is that a word? Exacerbation?
I'll accept it.
Is that the now exacerbation? I guess. Why not? Of what threats there are. And yet it's kind of hard to get anybody's attention. And that's partly because, you know, as is famously said, Americans don't care about foreign policy much unless tons of Americans are coming home in body bags. So foreign policy is left to a relatively small number of groups with intense interests in the outcome.
Yeah.
That's who pours the money into Washington. That's it, who puts pressure on the politicians. But it must be frustrating for you. Because at least I'm not in the business, right? I don't spend most of my hours trying to persuade people on foreign policy. This is your job.
Frustrating. It's frustrating. And, you know, what's ironic about the politics is that presidents these days seem to have very little ability to really do a big, good job on their domestic priorities. Partisanship has led to somewhat of a stasis. And, the real power of the executive is in foreign policy. And so, yes, it's true. Most Americans don't care about foreign policy. Therefore, they don't vote on it. But in terms of what the executive actually does, what he or she has the power to do, seems to me foreign policy should be one of the most important priorities for voters. It isn't. I think if Americans knew that we were helping starve 14 million Yemenis, maybe they would have an opinion on whether or not we should be doing that. But they don't know it because they're not incentivized to know it. They're rationally ignorant of these things because what they're more focused on is pocketbook issues, paying for healthcare, getting kids to school, et cetera.
To get back to Iran briefly, I mean, how concerned are you? I mean, on the one hand, Iran, I think actually, if you look at actual Iranian behavior, the Iranian armed forces, they've traditionally been pretty restrained and actually careful. I mean, maybe you could cite counterexamples, but for example, there's been virtually no retaliation against Israel for Israel's continued strikes in Syrian territory on Iranians and Iranian proxies and killing of them. But we are now hearing these things, you know, and you said that, well, if it's true that Iran is going to scale back its compliance with the nuclear deal, that would just be for show. Well, fine. But John Bolton is probably looking for an excuse like that to start something. I mean, I don't think you can rule out some kind of false flag operation on the part of somebody in that region, given Bolton's manifest willingness to exploit any opportunity to start a war with Iran. So, I mean, how are you? Are you not worried right now?
I'm super worried. Yeah, it's a concern. Bolton, like you said, and many of Trump's hawkish advisors are ready and willing to seize upon any Iranian actions that can be interpreted as a threat to U.S. interests or our allies' interests. And, you know, the more we escalate under the assumption that the Iranians won't take these actions, the greater likelihood that they actually will. And even if Trump, who's the guy at the top and would ultimately have to say yes or no to military action against Iran, you know, he's a guy that doesn't want to be seen to be backing down. And when we make threats and we don't live up to them, that creates a huge incentive to actually do something. So, yes, I mean, they're doing ridiculous things right now. They're citing Iran's alleged relationship with Al-Qaeda.
Which is right out of the Iraq War playbook.
It sure is. Pompeo went in testimony in the Senate a couple weeks ago. Rand Paul asked him, hey, do you think that the AUMF covers action against Iran? And Pompeo declined to answer the legal question, but he said, and I'm paraphrasing close to a quote, he said, the connection between Iran and Al-Qaeda is clear, period, full stop. So this just is an indication of how broad they view their powers and how willing they are to fabricate information in order to sell a hostile approach to Iran. And so, yeah, there's a very real risk that this is escalated in an even inadvertent way, at least by Trump, if not by his advisors.
Yeah. So I have a final question that is, this is kind of a hobby horse of mine. I've had trouble getting people to really agree with me on this. And it's about the role of oil in our Middle Eastern policy. It is commonly said, I mean, first of all, it's kind of a trope on the left. Left-wing critics of American foreign policy are often inclined to say it's all about oil. Beyond that, it is actually, I mean, nominally, it is part of American foreign policy going back to, I guess it was the Carter Doctrine, where Carter said, you know, we will, if our oil supply in the Middle East is imperiled, we will take extraordinary action, you know, intervention. I forget exactly, but that certainly seems to support the idea that oil looms large in our Middle East policy. And my feeling is it may or may not, but if it does, that's crazy for the following reason. And here's what I want your feedback on. It's like, I mean, here's what I mean. It is said that, like, we need to stay on good terms with these oil powers because they have the oil. Well, I mean, look, unless they want to commit economic suicide, they're going to sell the oil. And it doesn't matter whether they sell it to us. If they sell it to somebody else instead of us, the total amount of oil on the market stays the same. The price we pay for oil will stay the same. You know, we will buy it from someone who had been selling it to someone else who's now buying it from Saudi Arabia. I mean, it just seems to me that the only way the only kind of actual problem that could be generated is if Saudi Arabia says, we're just going to hold all the oil off the oil market entirely, which A, would be suicidal, and B, would be punishing the entire world. So it's not like it would be punishment of the U.S. in particular. I mean, has this occurred to you that there's something crazy about the constant citation of oil as a reason to do all the stuff we do?
Yes. As you explained, oil is a fungible commodity traded on international markets, subject to the laws of supply and demand. We don't need we should have a working relationship with countries in the Middle East in the same way that I think we should have robust diplomatic relations with all countries. The claim is not about U.S. access to oil. I mean, we don't even import much oil directly from the Middle East. The claim, and this goes back to what I was talking about before, this hegemonic stability theory. The claim is that as the world leader, we need to make sure that the choke point in the Strait of Hormuz stays open. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to maintain a constant, permanent U.S. military force there to make sure that no country will threaten to close it or anything like this. But as you say, it's not in their economic interest to close it. In fact, the economies of places like Saudi Arabia are so decrepit, so reliant on oil that even an advanced economy like the United States wouldn't willingly cut off and stop exporting its own oil and so on. But these countries are so dependent on oil exports that it'd be insane. And the likelihood of that happening is just very little. But also, you know, Iran doesn't even have the capability to close the strait. I mean, we would have to mine the strait. Tankers are resistant to that kind of thing. I mean, at best, it would be a major disruption, but it's a very low probability event that that kind of thing would even happen. Our military presence, if anything, is damaging to international oil markets. I mean, we're the ones taking Venezuelan oil off the market, Iranian oil off the market. This is no way to protect international oil markets. The reason we keep doing it is because of certain pathologies in U.S. foreign policy, some of which I talked about. Since we're already there, we end up adopting all kinds of other responsibilities in the region. And so I think, you know, most people when they hear about the Middle East, they don't really hear about oil. It's not a good strategic justification for our continued presence. Oil markets
have changed.
But
it's not my imagination, right? The view that we kind of agree doesn't make any economic sense is right. Pretty prevalent, right?
Yeah, at least in academia. But most people, I mean, the policy discussion on the Middle East is mostly terrorism, protecting Israel,
yeah.
You know, all this kind of stuff. And so it's supplemental to our protection of oil markets.
Okay, final question. You mentioned Venezuela, and you know, Venezuela is, I would think it's a little tough for somebody of your persuasion, because on the one hand, you're non-interventionist, and it's like, who the hell are we to impose these economic sanctions or to threaten military force or anything else? On the other hand, you can't be a fan of the Maduro regime. I mean, people at Cato are not generally big fans of socialist regimes, and you probably are among those who think that at least a significant part of Venezuela's economic problems derive from the policies of a socialist regime and are not entirely a function of U.S. sanctions or so on and so on. So what is your take on Venezuela?
It's a domestic issue. I mean, they have a legitimate dispute about who should be ruling the country. There, it does seem to be a part of the Constitution that the leader of the National Assembly can make the move that Juan Guaido has made, if it's widely deemed that the current guy in power is illegitimate. You know, a lot of countries have recognized Guaido as the legitimate president. I think that's okay. But beyond that, I don't think it's any of our business. And we're, again, making the situation worse. We're imposing very harsh economic sanctions, which, I mean, economic sanctions are always a form of collective punishment, but it's actually exacerbating an already intense situation of economic deprivation. And so we're making things worse. And we're also militarizing the situation, threatening that we'll use force. I mean, Venezuela is a big country. There's 32 million people. It's twice the size of Iraq. They have 350,000 people in arms. It would take, you know, enormous U.S. military commitment to do anything militarily in there, and it wouldn't go well. It would be another prolonged military occupation that would be possibly even more costly than Iraq was. This is a domestic issue. It's none of our business. And if we even, if we're going to claim any fealty at all to the UN Charter and a liberal international order, we need to start butting out of Venezuela's business and maybe at best do something internationally to encourage some kind of political settlement to the extent that negotiations facilitated by the outside could do something. But I'm very, very skeptical of that. And we've already made ourselves, you know, unwanted as a mediator. So we need to stay out.
Okay. Well, that was definitive enough. Thank you very much, John Glazer. Where can people find your stuff? And first of all, your what's your Twitter handle?
JWC Glazer.
GLASER is the last part. I am at Robert Reiter, WRIGHTER. We've already said they should be looking out for your book, Fuel to the Fire, in the fall. What else should they look at? Is there any place else they should look?
Well, you can find my bio page at cato.org. Other than that, you should probably avoid me.
Okay, so avoid John. And but if you want to if you want to make up for all the donors who pulled out of supporting Cato after Cato opposed the Iraq War, send your money directly to John. Is that right?
Yeah, directly to me. Don't bother.
Bitcoins.
Yeah, I'm not set up for that. I'm a bad libertarian in that I know nothing about Bitcoin.
Yeah, seriously. I wouldn't admit that if I were you. Okay, thanks a lot, John. This was great.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.